Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network. You can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Always well.
I wanted to talk with you today about the article that appeared a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times on that small restaurant. What's the name of it? Bellotto's?
Bellotto's, tiny little restaurant Bellotto's. Down in Soho... NoHo, that area.
Nolita,
that's where it is.
Nolita, yeah. So, I thought it was a really interesting article because it raised a couple of points. The article was on the front page of the food section of the New York Times, and it says, like Rao's, which is the famously difficult to get into restaurant in New York City, but you can get in. Of course, when they have a little place that they say it's a little secret joint that you can get
in,
and then it's on the front page of the food section of the Times.
You can't get in anymore.
Maybe you can't get in anymore. But they raised a couple of really interesting points. They started talking with Scott Conant, and Scott's a chef who's been on the show and a great
guy. Owns a restaurant called Scarpetta.
Yeah, terrific place. And he was talking about how he found Bellotto's, which is very good food, and it's kind of a dive with its sort of a dumpy exterior. And this is the secret hideaway place that so many, like, cocktail bars pretend to be.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of folks know about it. However...
But no website, no business cards, the whole deal.
And two things... And it's not super elegant inside either. It's kind of,
Yeah, I think not super elegant might be saying how nice it is.
So Scott Conant walks in, and he's having some Italian food, some of which is sort of difficult to produce, and it's spot on. And he's like, where the hell am I, as far as food is concerned? And then he's looking at the photos on the walls, and the photos on the walls are Lenny Kravitz, David Bowie, John Bon Jovi, Snoop Dogg, Sheryl Crow, and he's like, and they're like, this isn't like the old frame picture of Frank Sinatra from 1965 mm-hmm. when he stopped in and had a bowl of pasta. So the question is, what is this restaurant all about? And it seems as though, according to the article, that a lot of celebrities go to this restaurant, and it has a lot of great food. No website, doesn't have business cards, and it's not trying to be a secret place. It's just a small private place.
It just is a secret place.
And the Emilio Vitolo is the owner, is the chef and owner. He bought the place, and he runs it very privately. And I think one of the really interesting things about it as far as celebrity is concerned that I think people really appreciate, first of all, it's good food and it's quality. And secondly, in interviewing him, he says that he feels the customers have a right to be left alone. And the article goes on to say, and I'll quote, that puts him in sharp opposition to scores of Manhattan restaurateurs who feed in-house celebrity sightings to gossip columnists. And what Lenny Kravitz says about this place is, I've been there with some people, relationships, personal stuff, and anybody else would have dropped a dime on me, to get the big scoop. And Emilio has never betrayed our friendship. It's in a restaurateur's interest if you want the limelight, and the limelight brings you in customers and money and has
Absolutely.
You the place to be, to drop a dime and say, I've got the celebrity in my restaurant, and to sort of make a showcase of it. And that this guy doesn't do that and values the privacy of his guests, whether they're famous or not, I think that's really great.
I do, too. I mean, listen, we operate a couple of restaurants. We're next to three theaters. We get famous people into the restaurant all the time. But one of the things that I think is my duty as a restaurant owner is to make that person have an enjoyable restaurant experience.
Yep.
And when they want to be in the limelight, if they want to go, stand in the bar room and talk to everybody and sign autographs, they can do that if they want. And if they want to go sit in the back corner in the booth and be kind of silent and in the back corner and unknown.
And be a private person.
Then they can do that, too. And, what I find is generally when I have somebody who's famous or a celebrity or somebody like that, I'm sticking them in the back booth or in a back corner where they can't be seen. And, okay, maybe my guests will catch them as they're walking through the dining room on their way out or on their way in and those kinds of things. But I do think it's a restaurateur's obligation to make sure that those people are – left alone if they want to be left alone.
You know, and I think that we've stopped many a person who was it that was in oh my God, I can't remember his name. The guy from he played Paul Robeson on Broadway and
Avery Brooks.
Mm-hmm. He was terrific. And Avery Brooks is a really serious guy we've known for a long time. And
most people know him from Deep Space Nine.
Deep Space Nine. And it's funny because he sort of bemoaned that fact a little bit one night when he was at the bar. And he's a professor at Rutgers. Mm-hmm. He's a super intelligent guy. He played Othello in New York on Broadway, right? And he played Paul Robeson. And one night he's sitting at the bar and somebody was coming over to talk to him. And they all wanted to, you know, get the... whatever his character, and it's funny, I know that he played Othello, but I don't know his character in Deep Space Nine, and they wanted to get his autograph for that, and he said, and he was cool about it, he was very cool about it, but he said, you know, I'm a full professor at Rutgers, I've done a lot in the theater, there's a lot mm-hmm. in my life that I'm proud of, and I'm going to be known as the captain from Deep Space Nine for, mm-hmm. and I thought, and I said to him, I said, yeah, but you're going to be doing it in a swell condo. He said, yeah, you got a point. But there were a couple of times when he was in the dining room that people were going to go over and mm-hmm. say hello, and you stop them. And you're like, no, you're not going over there. Because
right.
that's not what this is about. This isn't a park bench or a public place. And right. some people want to come in and be noticed, and they want a dime to be dropped on them, and they want to be the center of attention. And that's great, but a lot of folks don't. And you need to respect that.
Yeah. I just, it's amazing how people just want to be close to a celebrity that way.
Yeah.
And people feel like they forget that the person's out to dinner with their family, their kids, whomever might have come to the show to see them that night, or they might be in town to see one of their friends in one of the shows.
Well, and also, I think any public person, you know, one of the things we really try to avoid, and there's a friend of ours who's since passed away, who had a very influential restaurant in New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
And when politicians were in to his restaurant that there was a matter pending before that he felt passionate about because he was on the Restaurant Association board and there mm-hmm. were issues in downtown New Brunswick and he was a very involved civic person, he thought really nothing of going up to the congressman, the mayor, the senator and saying, you know, Senator, what do you think about this bill? And I tell you, I never do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very blessed that there are a lot of folks who, because they know me from the restaurant, will take my call
right.
and
when
return
the
my email. And if I call and say, hey, you know we have a personal relationship. Can I come and see you about something during your work hours in your office? You know, we have some entree with people, and I'm very grateful for that.
I get it, entree with people.
Ah, I love it. But I will never bother them during their entrees. You get it? Get it?
Yeah.
Get it? Yeah.
Some right. jokes are funnier than others.
But, you know, I think people have a right to be left alone by both other patrons and by us. They're not coming to us to continue their workday, even mm-hmm. if they're a public person. They're coming to be a private person with us, and that's a great compliment, you know? So that's my view on it, and I think that more restaurateurs should be the same. And I think that when you have a celebrity in your dining room and you drop a dime on them when you don't know, when they don't want it so the paparazzi can find them if they're not out there already, I think that's kind of lame, actually.
Well, here's what I'm going to tell you. There are certain places that those popular people go to
right.
in order to be noticed.
Right.
So those, you know, that's part of the game that's played sometimes too.
But if
I just choose not to have one of those places.
And if you clearly understand your guest's intent, and there are some folks who've come in who really like talking to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can think of a few mm-hmm. celebs who like to sit front and center
sure.
in the window and
sure.
hold court. And God bless them. That's great. They can use my restaurant for that. And there are some folks who like to hide in the back.
Well, but at
Not,
the same
or,
time,
or be in the back.
I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of a great couple who have frequented our restaurant, Stilla and Mira. Okay.
Ben's
parents.
Ben's parents.
Okay. Have come into the restaurant, and there are occasions where they walk around and they say hello to everybody and
mm-hmm.
they you know, sign autographs or share stories or do whatever, you know, it suits them. And there are occasions when they want to be tucked into the back corner and they want to have a family dinner.
Well, and there are occasions when Jerry Stiller wants to, you know, talk to everybody in the restaurant and Ann Mira wants to just and they're great. They're
very
actually
true.
They're a very funny couple because they are very much in person like they appear
they are
on
very
stage.
Much in person like
and
they
just
appear.
Like, Jerry, let's go.
Actually, Jerry's a little more subdued than his characters for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. No, certainly, but I mean it is and they're funny to just talk
to
and
they
chat
are very
with.
Amusing.
And good. Anyway, so that's my advice to restaurateurs. I don't know if anybody's going to take any heed of it at all.
I will.
Thanks, Mark. Well, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is Daniel Hume. Daniel is the chef at 11 Madison Park, one of our favorite restaurants and one of the best restaurants in New York City. And the occasion of Daniel's visit coincides with the publication of the 11 Madison Park Cookbook.
Daniel Hume, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be on it.
Well, I am not surprised that the cookbook is almost as impressive as dinner in the restaurant.
No. You know, for us, you know, it was, I mean, for a chef to bring out a cookbook, it's kind of a big deal, and it's a real, you know, reflection. And so, you know, we've been working on it for the last 2 years, and finally now, you know, it comes out. You know, it's really, it came out really beautiful and really stunning with incredible photographs, but also I think it's, you know, it's kind of, we try to make it a little bit more accessible. Although it's exactly the dishes how we cook them at the restaurant, we give little tips and we break the recipes apart so you can also do just, you know, a few elements of the recipe, so you don't have to make the entire dish. In the back of the book, we have a whole section on different purees, like vegetable purees or fruit purees. We have a section on different kinds of flavored oils, or we have a section on different kind of granolas, like savory granolas, sweet granolas. We have a section on ice creams and sorbets, so it's really cool, I think, for somebody at home to kind of understand how a dish is put together. But also, you know, what we do in a restaurant, we have to recreate, you know, every lunch service and every dinner service, and we're only as good as our last service, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're an architect or a painter, you maybe, it maybe takes a long time to work on a piece or a building, but then it's there forever. And that was really exciting for us to do a cookbook that we then know it's going to be there forever. And, you know, you can look back on it and see where we were and see the evolution. And, I think the restaurant 11 Madison Park is at a really, important time. And we just wanted to capture that moment. And I think the book does a really good job at just capturing how it is today, right now. And I couldn't be more, you know, proud and excited.
I think the book is interesting in a number of ways. It functions, if you're looking for a Christmas present for a friend, as a coffee table book. And I think that it, in that it's beautiful.
Only if you have a very sturdy coffee table.
It's not a small book. And it is a beautiful book, and as an object art itself is lovely. And but the recipes are technically correct. And as I looked through these recipes, you know, with some sous vide cooking and a little bit of liquid nitrogen here and there, I think, well, you know, we might be inspired to try and execute some of these ourselves, either Mark and I in our crazy home kitchens or restaurant professionals certainly would look to be inspired by these and take them and go somewhere with them. But you have a disclaimer in the beginning of your book, and right up front you answer the question, will people be actually able to cook from this book? And your simple answer is yes-ish. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
No, I think a lot of people, you know, especially in today's day, I think people want recipes that are, you know, done in 20 minutes, your 20-minute meal or your half-an-hour meal. And I think the recipes are not that difficult by itself, but they do take a commitment. And the commitment, for the most part, is time. And, you know, cooking just takes time. And even, to be honest, sometimes even when I cook a simple soup for my family at home, if I do it the right way, it could take me an hour just to make like a butternut squash soup. But you know, I cut the onions properly and the vegetables properly, and I sweat it, you know, slowly, and I reduce it, and so forth. And you know, to make great food with no time is kind of an illusion. So I think, you know, in this book, you can do many of the recipes if you're committed to it and you, you know, you really take the time to do it and you have a decent kitchen. And for the most part, with the sous vide cooking and with the liquid nitrogen, we do give alternatives how it could be done without it.
Well, Chef, I'll give you a great compliment. In our office, which has a very extensive library, so I'm sure yours does too, and you would guess, over the last month, your cookbook has been the most passed around book in our office.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
That makes me happy.
And I will tell you that our chef has said that it is the most beautiful cookbook he's ever seen.
Yeah, and he said that as I said, I really need that back for the show today. Can I have it?
Oh, I'm really happy. That makes me really happy because for us, you know, also the visual aspect of it was really important. And, you know, it was also important that it really reflects the restaurant. Like when you look at the book, you feel like you have a piece of 11 Madison. And you know, with the white cover and all that, the book is totally in white. And, in the beginning, you know, publisher would say, you know, really, do you want to really have it in white? It's, you know, it gets dirty quickly. And also in the bookstores, who is going to pick out the white book? You know, it should be something more colorful. But that's not what 11 Madison Park is. So we really wanted to have it feel like a piece of the restaurant. And I think it does.
The Beatles had a fairly good success with the White album. So
you know, Frances and I have been to your restaurant on several occasions each, but maybe a lot of our listeners haven't. Why don't you talk about the feel of 11 Madison? Because I think you've really captured something there other places don't.
I think it is a unique restaurant in New York, not only because it's, you know, highly rated by Michelin and Zagat and everyone else, but it's a unique. It's its own thing. It really is. It's quite an achievement.
Our goal was really to kind of, you know, redefine what it means, like 4-star New York Times or 3 Michelin stars, and to have it feel more youthful and fun, because, you know, we've all been to these restaurants with our parents maybe, and you know, they were really formal and the food maybe was really good, but it just really always felt like they weren't much fun and you couldn't really laugh and you had to put on clothes that you didn't really want to put on. And we just wanted to change all that, but still have incredible food with incredible hospitality. So, you know, we don't have a dress code, and in our restaurant, people do laugh, and it is fun, and, you know, people are comfortable asking questions, and we're very, you know, welcoming to also people who are, you know, young and maybe from our business who usually are not comfortable in these, you know, fancy restaurants. I remember when I first started cooking, you know, I was, like, scared even looking into these restaurants, you know, when I was, like, going to Paris or so. I was walking around, and of course I wanted to go see where all these, you know, well-known restaurants are. And then, you know, looking into the window, you're like almost scared, and you know, you would never, you know, want to go in there and eat because you would just feel so uncomfortable. And I think that whole thing we don't really believe in. I think it should be fun. It should be welcoming, because that's really the core of what restaurants should be, right? A place to get together. And
you know, I think that one of the things that you do that I've always thought of things slightly differently, and that certainly you do turn the paradigm of the fine dining restaurant on its head. And I think one of the things you do that is actually fun is if you are comfortable in fancy restaurants and fine dining restaurants, and you walk into 11 Madison Park, you sort of make, to jumble things up a little bit, you make it a little maybe uncomfortable for some, and in a fun sort of a way. I mean, straight down to the design of your menu. You know, if you walk in with set expectations you might be made to feel uncomfortable. Why don't you tell us about your menu and what people encounter when they arrive at 11 Madison Park?
Well, our menu was, you know, we really, I think one important thing is like we ask ourselves, what can we do that in like 50 years, people will look back on New York dining and say, you know what, you know, these restaurants really made a difference and really made an impact. And when you just follow what other restaurants are doing, you're not going to have that sort of impact. So you got to be, you got to have your own point of view. And the menu, you know, was a great opportunity, I think, to do that, because usually, you know, on a a la carte menu, it's really the guest saying, you know, oh, I want the salad and then the fish and then the beef and then, you know, the dessert and, you know, and kind of tells the waiter, you know, please go get that for me and I want to eat. And then with a tasting menu, it's more like the restaurant saying, okay, this is the menu and you're going to eat exactly what we want and how we want it. And that's that. And we felt like the ordering of a menu should be much more of a dialogue than just a monologue. And so the way we list our dishes are only by principal ingredients. So you could see on a menu, you could see butternut squash, scallops, you could see lobster, beef or lamb, and without knowing what, and each of those represents a dish, and you don't know what is, you know, how is it served and how is it meant, you know, what do we have in mind. And so we asked the guest of any allergies or any dislikes or ingredients that he's really in the mood in beyond the ingredient, the main ingredient. And so then we can kind of customize the menu to their liking. So it's almost like, you know, when you go to a, if you have a suit made and, you know, you go to the place and you pick your fabric, you pick your buttons and you pick your cut and based on that, you have a suit made to measure. And so our menu is kind of like a menu made to measure.
So I've always wondered how that works. I mean, I think one of the things that people have as an impression is that you come up with some ideas and the chef then, you know, creates from scratch, you know, a menu just for you. It can't be like that. I mean, you have certain dishes in your repertoire for the evening that you may move here
and
or
certain
there.
Certain ingredients, obviously.
So who makes the decision and what are the parameters in with which the person when they get and what's communicated to the kitchen by the waiter? How does that get communicated? Because one of the things we see in a busy restaurant is the waiter comes back and communicates exactly to the chef what the guest has ordered, and
yeah.
Then the guest, you know, that's on a computer screen, and the guest and the kitchen can begin working on that dish. You have a much more complex set of things to communicate, and then a more complex set of decisions to make. How does that happen?
You know, we obviously we have always a plan in mind for each ingredient. You know, and sometimes people just say, hey, you know, I want to be surprised. And then we always have a, you know, a go-to option. So let's say the beef is with porcini mushrooms and potatoes as we intended it. Then, you know, if the guests say, oh, let's just surprise me with the beef, then he would get the beef with, you know, mushrooms and potatoes. But then if... You know, and then we have, like, you know, anything, like, that's really in season, we kind of have in-house, like vegetables and you know, vegetables and greens and fish and stuff. Whatever is in season that's really seasonal, we usually have in-house. And then we maybe have, you know, maybe somebody says, you know, I really want the beef, but I want to eat, you know, kind of light today. I don't feel like a lot of starch, and, you know, I had a big lunch today. So then, obviously, then we would maybe do the beef, you know, maybe still with the mushrooms, and maybe we would, you know, serve it with some braised lettuces and mushrooms and the beef instead of, you know, the potato. And, you know, and the same thing if somebody says, you know, I really want the beef, but, you know, I'm not really a mushroom person. And then we, you know, we would have a plan for if it's, you know, with no mushrooms.
So here's what interests me. I've dined at your restaurant. It's a wonderful adventure. I've had, and usually other people have taken me out and paid the bill, which makes it all the more fun. You know, I find
makes it an even more wonderful adventure.
Yeah, it's really great. But we have a conversation with a waiter, and the waiter, you know, takes his or her time to, you know, have a little conversation about exactly sort of along the lines of what you just said, of like,
right,
you know, I'm feeling a little light today, and maybe I like tomatoes. As a guy who's been doing this for 20 years in the restaurant business, how does the waiter then? I mean, I can't imagine that the waiter goes back and has a little conversation with the sous chef about everything that particular diner wants. Or am I wrong? Is that how it happens?
Well, you know, if there's, we have certain buttons that would be put in with the order. You know, when, I mean, for everyone out there who doesn't know exactly how it works, how an order, the waiter takes the order, and then he goes to a little computer and he puts in the order. And on that order, you can specify certain things, but of course you don't want to be too lengthy because then you're going to be on the computer for too long and not with the guests. So if it says like beef, no mushrooms, you know, that's easy. But if it's like, you know, if it's a more holistic thing about the entire meal, that how the guests want to eat, then actually the waiter does come in the kitchen and speaks to the chef and explains exactly kind of the conversation that happened at the table. So we can really be in tune what the guests really want.
That, and I tell you, you know, when you look at a restaurant like that, to be able to take that amount of time, and for anyone on the line to be able to take that amount of time to talk about holistically what a guest wants, that's an incredible thing during the course of a busy service. There's a lot of stuff going on for you to have structured a kitchen where people can take some time and have a brief conversation that then affects the meal that's going on. That's a huge investment.
We've never taken, you know, the easy route. I think whenever you want to create something special, You gotta, you know, push the envelope, and you gotta push yourself and push your team. And, you know, if we just want to do the easy way, yeah, you would never do that, of course.
Francis mentioned just a minute ago, you know, talking about, you know, holistic approach. And I want you to know that I use 11 Madison Park when discussing great restaurants and the future of great restaurants very frequently now. Because one of the things you've done is, yes, of course your food is wonderful and it's spectacularly prepared, and your service is wonderful, and you have a great wine list, and, you know, Francis and I talk all the time that we were introduced to your restaurant. Actually, we had a friend who bartended there years and years ago, and we were introduced to your restaurant through the bar and through your cocktail list and through that part of your program. And I look at 11 Madison Park, and I look at it as a complete restaurant. And I see a lot of very good restaurants out there aren't complete restaurants. But it does seem like you've taken a holistic approach where care is taken to every part of what you're doing.
No, I think our mentality is like, okay, if we serve cocktails, you know, it better be one of the best cocktails that New York has. And, you know, with the same, you know, we have a tea service. And, you know, we do, you know, table sides, oolong, matcha tea, pu'er. And, like, we just want to, you know, we feel like, okay, if we serve tea, it's got to be the best tea service or one of the best or, you know, one that we really believe in. And the same with beer. We have an incredible, you know, beer program. And, the wine and, you know, the obvious things. But I think, like, anything we do, we just want to do really well. And the way we the way we succeed is that we put people, you know, captains or servers or managers or whoever we feel like knows a lot about a certain thing or has a lot of interest in, for example, beer or the tea or, you know, anything that we do, we put somebody in charge of it. And what? Then what you get, you have a staff that shows extreme ownership and also dedication and loyalty, and they can create something that maybe in another restaurant on a certain level they couldn't. And and then, you know, we, of course, everything goes through Will and me, but they have the opportunity to present then, okay, this is how we think the tea service should be, and then maybe we push back a little bit, or we, you know, or we think it's great or whatever. But in the end, everyone on our team has a certain pride, a certain project that they, you know, fully put themselves into it, and they're so proud of that. In the end, it almost becomes easier, much easier to manage, because it's, you know, the person who created the tea program is not going to mess it up, because mm-hmm. they're so proud of it.
And they're not going to let anybody else mess it up either.
Everybody's
exactly.
Everybody's pulling the sled.
Everyone holds each other accountable. Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of someone, you know, maybe a waiter in the restaurant, but also they run the tea program, and somebody else may be a cook in the restaurant, but they run the cheese program. And That is really fascinating, and you're also not going to let anybody else's program fall down, because they have to hold up your program as well. It's a beautiful way to manage things. It really is.
It's been working really well, and, you know, we have very little turnover, and I think in our business it's all about the people. I mean, you know, you can have great food, great wine, but in the end we are in the people business, and you need to have great people, and the people need to be happy, and that's it. You know, that's really, I almost see that as my primary job. Like, my job is to make sure people are satisfied and happy, and they learn, and they are pushed, and they, you know, they, because that's what they want. That's why they come here. You know, they want to grow. They want to be, you know, every day they want to have a challenge and succeed, and so. And really, in the end of the day, as a leader of a restaurant like this, it's almost like being a coach of
sure.
a sports team or so.
I think the thing about any great chef is that the chef position is a leadership position. The chef doesn't cook every dish. The chef makes sure that every dish, whether he cooks or not, is terrific. And, you know, it's a rather large team. And we should take a quick break, but I want to come back on the other side and talk about just how massive an almost military operation turning out lunch and dinner at 11 Madison Park can be. So will you stick with us through the break?
Great.
We'll be back with Daniel Hume, from the chef from 11 Madison Park and author of the 11 Madison Park cookbook with Will Gudara, the manager. You can find out more about this book and about 11 Madison Park at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to us on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is Danielle Hume from 11 Madison Park. And we're talking about 11 Madison Park and the new cookbook that's come out there. I mentioned before the break that, you know, one of the things in this book that is really beautiful is you have a diagram of the restaurant and you sort of have a day in the life of a restaurant, which is really fascinating. And I think that a lot of folks who are not in the restaurant industry would, and even some folks who are, would be really surprised at just how full a 20-hour day of the restaurant can be. And it strikes me, you were talking about being a coach. There's a bit of a coach and a bit of a commander, because everything has to happen, and everything has to happen on time, you know, and precisely. And so there's an element of almost a military operation with such a large restaurant doing such complex service two times a day, don't you think?
Well, I think it definitely, on a daily operational basis, there's definitely, you know, it definitely needs like this kind of hierarchy where, you know, there's a chef and there's a sous chef and then there's, you know, the person below them and the person below them and you know, in the dining room, the same thing. You know, during service, whoever is in charge, you know, is in charge because we don't have the luxury of having huge discussions. You know, during a service to make it happen. But so definitely on a daily basis, it's like kind of military, you know, a little bit like a military hierarchy. But then the important thing is that by the end of the day or in the afternoon or in our meetings, it's not that approach at all. It's very collaborative and, you know, from the lowest paid position to the highest, everyone's opinion matters, and also, you know, we've gotten amazing ideas from people who just started with us, and I think we really encourage that kind of environment that everyone has the opportunity to give their ideas or opinions.
Well, sometimes you need just fresh eyes too. That always helps.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah.
And you've eliminated, you've banished the terms front of house and back of house. Why did you banish those terms, and in favor of what?
No, because it has like, you know, front and back, it just has like that kind of negative sound to it. And, you know, it's just the kitchen and the dining room. And, you know, although we don't have like, or many of us don't have, like, you know, secondary education, we look at what we do, you know, very much as, like, you know, a ground for people to get that secondary education. And we try to carry ourselves in a way that, you know, we're real professionals, although, you know, we put in, years and years of really hard work, and maybe not in a school, but you know, we really look at ourselves that it's a real profession. And I think, you know, it's the dining room and it's the kitchen.
Chef, you opened this restaurant with Danny Meyer, one of the most renowned restaurateurs in all of New York City. And frankly, at this point, all of the world. Mm-hmm. Things are changing at 11 Madison Park though. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on?
Well, you know, Will Gadara and I, we've been working together for the past 6 years here at 11 Madison, and we've been, you know, managing the restaurant, but even more so, we've been, you know, creating the restaurant, and you know, we both had different experiences before. But 6 years ago, Danny Meyer brought us together here to really, you know, revamp the restaurant, because Danny had the vision that 11 Madison Park deserves to be one of the great restaurants in the world. And, you know, and it's been incredible the last 6 years. We have made, you know, we've learned so much, and we have had great experiences. And also with working with Danny, you know, Danny is one of the, you know, the best. I mean, I haven't met anyone better. And he has taught us, you know, so much, and he has guided us so well. And, you know, now, 6 years later, you know, Danny opened his first restaurant when he was 27. And we're now, you know, in our 30s. And, we, you know, Will and I have bonded and become, you know, very, very close friends. And, you know, we know that we want to, you know, that we're going to stay together and in our, you know, whatever we're going to do. So I think it's just our time. And, you know, I mean, Danny was, you know, just incredible about, you know, understanding and helping us to get this opportunity to eventually own 11 Madison, without him. And I think, you know, in Europe, you see it more often that kind of the torch gets passed off to the next generation. And therefore, you know, there are restaurants who have been around for 200-300 years on a very high level because it always has been passed off. And I think, this is maybe not a very, very American approach, but, you know,
we throw everything away. We're done with it. We throw it out. That's American.
Yeah, it's all used. Put it in the dump.
So how long do you think it will take to complete the buyout? What's the plan that before you guys will be the owners of 11 Madison Park?
You know, I think it's in this process. I've learned that everything has taken a lot longer than we expected because there's so many different moving parts. But we are very close, and it's certain that it will be done by the end of the year, the end of the year.
That's great. And I've always wondered about this. Does Danny Meyer get to eat there free for life as part of the would that be a...
Francis says that as you know, just in case we ever sell our places.
Well, yeah. I would say he will eat there for free for life, yes.
Extraordinary. let's see if we can get invited along for one of those. All right, so I have one chef.
No, but you know, I mean, I just want to add, you know, Danny has been such a mentor to the two of us, and I mean, he really is the very best in our business.
Yeah.
And to still be our names come up with his name. I mean, it's just incredible. And you know, I'm so fortunate. And you know, Danny is an incredible person. I mean he is an incredible professional, but beyond that, he is just an incredible person. And you know, he's real, he's down to earth, he couldn't be nicer. I mean, he has made a huge impact in my personal life, but also in my career. So
And as far as those of you guys in the business, or even outside of our particular business, a way to run an organization, Danny's been on the show a couple of times, but last time it was to discuss his book, Setting the Table.
Yeah.
And that is just, it is, I mean, go to restaurantguysradio.com and listen to the show, but also pick up that book, and it's one of the best books written. And one of the ways that that book works is Danny has this uncanny knack for taking what good business people and good leaders sort of know intuitively, but Danny figures out how to put it into words, into a brief sentence, to make it all make sense so that you can use it and teach it. So he's amazing.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, he really helps to, you know, stuff we, yeah, exactly like you said, like stuff we do intuitively, and he knows how to put words to it. And if you have words, you can much more easily, you know, get other people to do it and understand it.
I have one final thing that I need to ask you, Chef Hume. You have 3 Michelin stars. You have 4 stars from the New York Times. You're one of the most highly rated chefs in one of the most highly rated restaurants in America that you're about to own. But the real mark of the impact on American culture is that our friend Jim Meehan's cocktail bar PDT, you actually have a hot dog named after you. Are you aware of this?
You know, I love PDT.
Uh-huh.
I think they're doing such an incredible job. And, you know, we love all the people there. And for us, I think what we said also, you know, to be the 4-star restaurant of the new generation, that's kind of also, you know, that's kind of a cool thing to do. I mean, we really believe in what they do. but I don't know if other four-star restaurants would want to, you know, dumb down their, you know, their brand, or they would maybe look at it that way. But we don't look at it that way. I mean, the hot dog is delicious. It's an incredible bar. Is it like 11 Madison Park? You know, in some ways it is, because they also are very focused in making, you know, the best bar there is. But in some ways it's not, but it's totally fine. And, you know, we really love the idea, and I think it's a really cool thing to do. And,
well, Daniel, I will tell you that I have been in both places on the same day.
We have.
Oh,
that's
good.
Right. I forgot about that. And I believe we made a stop at Shake Shack in between, as I recall. When we have a day off, we really make the most of it. But it's the Hum Dog. Actually, it should be the Hume Dog, right? At PDT. And it's a bacon wrapped hot dog topped with truffle mayo, Gruyere cheese, and celery radish. That will cost you less than a cocktail at 11 Madison Park. Daniel, thanks for coming on the show. The book is great. Your food is great, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, guys.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis.
Daniel talked about early in the show, he talked about, you know, peering in the windows of those French three-star Michelin restaurants, and they were just scary places.
Oui.
Do you remember way back when we went on a little tour of French three-star restaurants?
It was the 3 stars in 4 days. Uh-huh. It was the 3 3-stars in 4 days tour.
Yeah, exactly. And,
yeah.
And you and I had a great time. And I remember the juxtaposition of the two restaurants. And I'll say that the name of the nice one was Ducasse, and it was beautiful and wonderful.
You know what? They were a French Michelin three-star restaurant. Usually we don't say the name if you're...